Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Alice McKeon, your chair for today. We welcome our listening audience and we invite everyone to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. It is now my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Ambassador David Sheffer. Within days of her confirmation as UN ambassador in 1993, Madeleine Albright instructed David Sheffer to create a war crimes tribunal for the former Yugoslavia. As her senior advisor from 1993 to 1997, and subsequently as President Clinton's ambassador at large for war crimes issues from 1997 to 2001, Ambassador Sheffer was at the forefront of the efforts that led to criminal tribunals for the Balkans, Rwanda, Sierra Leone, and Cambodia. Ultimately, these resulted in the creation of the permanent International Criminal Court. This evening, he shall share his insights into the events in which he and many others here and around the world had a hand. Last month, he was appointed as the United Nations Secretary General's Special Expert on United Nations assistance to the Khmer Rouge trials in Cambodia. And last December, he was selected by Foreign Policy magazine as one of the top global thinkers of 2011. This is on the web and in the December 2011 issue of the magazine. He is the Meyer Brown and Robert A. Hellman Professor of Law and Director of the Center for International Human Rights at Northwestern University Law School. He has published his account of the years he served as ambassador and the period immediately following in All the Missing Souls, A Personal History of the War Crimes Tribunals. The title of his talk this evening is The End of Impunity. Please welcome Ambassador David Sheffer.
Thank you very much, Alice. That's a very kind introduction, and it's a tremendous pleasure for me to speak once again before the Commonwealth Club here in San Francisco, which is extremely well known throughout this country. When I was ambassador at large for war crimes issues, I had the privilege of speaking before the club, and I always remember that event and the questions that we had in the discussion afterwards. And it was such a distinct honor to be here. Well, I suppose that was 13, 14, 15 years ago, and it's an honor again to be here. And I have to be a good brother and note that my sister Claudia Gallo and her husband Mike Gallo are in the audience, and I'm so pleased that they are here tonight to join with all of you. I want to talk tonight about All the Missing Souls, Personal History of the War Crimes Tribunals. And I do so because every day the personal history recorded in my book resonates in contemporary international politics and law. Understanding why the highest political and military leaders are increasingly at risk of indictment and prosecution today, and why the mission of accountability grows with every passing year, requires looking back at least to the 1990s, when, as I write in my book, one of the most ambitious judicial experiments in the history of humankind, a global assault on the architects of atrocities, found its purpose as mass killings and ethnic cleansing consumed entire regions of the earth. The grand objective since 1993 has been to end impunity at the highest levels of government and the military, not only for genocide, which captures the popular imagination with its heritage in the Holocaust, but also for the far less understood offenses of crimes against humanity and war crimes. the building of institutions of international justice has had a lot to do with that new reality, namely that impunity is on the losing side of history now. Understanding why Muammar Gaddafi and his son Saif al-Islam were indicted by the International Criminal Court last year, why Sudan's current president Omar al-Bashir was indicted for genocide in Darfur and defies to this day the authority of the same court, why Radovan Karadzic and Ratko Mladic are finally standing trial in The Hague before the Yugoslav Tribunal, why former Liberian President Charles Taylor awaits the judgment of the Special Court for Sierra Leone, why three of the surviving top Khmer Rouge leaders of the Pol Pot regime are on trial today in Phnom Penh, and why the United Nations and the United States government are focusing more of their attention on atrocities prevention strategies today takes us back to the 1990s, when major failures occurred in reacting to atrocities, when the five major criminal tribunals were negotiated to lock in leadership accountability, and atrocities prevention efforts gained a foothold within the federal bureaucracy. And I do want to add, by the way, that because of my new UN appointment, I obviously speak strictly in my private capacity tonight. I had the lead American job in building the international criminal tribunals for the former Yugoslavia and Rwanda, the Special Court for Sierra Leone, the Extraordinary Chambers in the Courts of Cambodia, and the Permanent International Criminal Court. All the Missing Souls is the story of this transformational moment in history about the creation and rise of five war crimes tribunals during the 1990s. That task occupied all 8 years of the Clinton administration for me, so I want to spend a few moments talking about my own role as it frames the personal part of the history in this book. I was, as one civil society leader introduced me one day while I was ambassador to a group of interested listeners, I was the ambassador to hell, but also the ambassador to hell and back. In my more optimistic moments, I thought of myself as a carpenter of war crimes tribunals. The stark reality was that these courts would be the international community's frontal assault on impunity and often had to begin their work amidst ongoing atrocities. Now, my book is an insider's account. I tried to write what has not been covered in other books, but recognizing the rich body of literature that now explains many of these events. And I stand in awe of all of the academics, journalists, and others who have written on this decade of atrocities. I drew heavily from my personal notebooks and from declassified cables. So you really do see raw historical sources reflected in the writing of this book. During the first 4 years of the Clinton administration, I was on the Deputies Committee of the National Security Council, which thrust me into every major foreign policy decision of the Clinton administration's first term, and I had the first ever ambassadorship on war crimes then in the second term. I had the support of Madeleine Albright, who was a true leader on accountability for atrocity crimes. She was, for those 8 years, the most powerful woman in the world, period. First as ambassador, the U.S. permanent representative to the United Nations in the first term, and then as Secretary of State during the second term. With her support and leadership, I was able to press ahead, often against almost impossible resistance from the Pentagon, from Congress, from foreign allies and foes, from the United Nations even, from the intelligence community. I also describe in the book those situations where Ambassador Albright and I, or Secretary of State Albright and I, sometimes had some differences, but I think they were fair ones. I want to tell you that I started writing this book in 2001, right after I had left the administration, because I was a political appointee, and of course George W. Bush had won the election, so I needed to look for a new job. But I had a year at the U.S. Institute of Peace, and the thought was that I was going to sit down and write this book. I started to do so, and it was awful. It was just terrible writing. Why? Well, I think when you come out of a pressure cooker like that, when you've been so deeply immersed in the political and, for me, the legal framework of so much of what happened in the 1990s. You are very defensive. You are somewhat angry that you lost the election. You want your job back. And so your writing tends to reflect all of that defensiveness. And it's not clear. It's not balanced. You're not looking back with perspective that quickly after leaving government service. So I put it aside and went into the security of writing law review articles. But many years later, in 2007, I got a call from Princeton University Press basically saying, isn't now the time to write your book? And I thought about it, and I thought, well, yes, now really is the time. I've had time to read so much more of what other people have written about the 1990s, including Ambassador Albright's book. I had time to reflect and to be very, very self-critical. So I think what you see in this book is, first, a very self-critical examination of what happened in the 1990s, and the mistakes that the Clinton administration, in my view, made, and my own mistakes, as well as our accomplishments, of course. And I hope that that's reflected. In fact, even in the concluding chapter, I give you two or three pages where I summarize those mistakes just to make sure you got it after reading the narrative. Because I think it's just so important for government officials to come clean and really write in a balanced view about what they have been so deeply immersed in. Now, there is a lot in this book about the United Nations, about our fellow permanent members on the Security Council, about our European allies. There are insights about so many of the major figures in the Clinton administration and in international justice during those years. There are three chapters on the long negotiating saga around the International Criminal Court, about our failure to support the final text of the constitutional document for the court, but 2.5 years later, I had the privilege to sign it on behalf of the United States, and about the whole cast of negotiators who populated UN meeting rooms for years. This is, indeed, a diplomatic history, but with a very strong autobiographical insider context that I truly believe you will find a worthy narrative to read. I realized from the beginning of my tribunal building years in 1993 that there are many ways to approach the issue of evil, and there are now many books that brilliantly examine the sources of evil, not only for the Holocaust, but also for the atrocities of our own time. How do men and sometimes women of power so readily and efficiently embrace evil and decimate vast numbers of human beings? My book is not designed to answer that mega question, in part because I think the answers are so complex and varied from one atrocity situation to another that singular formulas are folly. Except one. Prosecutor Luis Moreno Ocampo of the International Criminal Court often observes that leaders who commit atrocity crimes keep doing so to maintain their power. I firmly believe that is a driving force behind evil in our time, just as it has been throughout recorded history. Now, consider the challenge we confronted in the 1990s, and particularly January 1993 when we entered office in the Clinton administration. There were regions of the world with mass atrocities, leadership perpetrators, usually an ongoing and vicious armed conflict, or at least a potentially resurgent one, a destroyed or failed court system, unwilling political leaders, and a skeptical international community much more focused on the peace or war equation of the conflict itself than on justice. That was the scenario facing us in so many atrocity zones, including in the Balkans, in Rwanda, and in Sierra Leone in the 1990s. Cambodia was different, only in that the atrocities had long ended, but the infrastructure was lacking and political landmines were all over the place. We were not starting from scratch because of the Nuremberg and Tokyo military tribunals decades earlier, but ours was a very different challenge under far more complex circumstances. This would not be victor's justice, although some have viewed it as the powerful imposing justice upon the weak. Modern international justice is no simple code of criminal procedure either. The quest for justice meanders back and forth between international and domestic courts. Yet the search for evil aimed for the civility of the courtroom and in the growing resolve that removing war criminals from politics and military leadership would make a difference. We have witnessed a transformational era in confronting what I call atrocity crimes, namely genocide, crimes against humanity, and war crimes. The last 20 years have been nothing but revolutionary in how the world responds to atrocity crimes. I do not mean to say we have learned how to effectively confront atrocities or the threat of them, and my book describes our failures in Rwanda, Bosnia, and Sierra Leone. But I do believe we have learned some lessons from those failures, and our actions in Kosovo in 1999, described in the book, and even more recently in Libya last year, point to a new understanding about the value of military intervention or other measures under the fast-evolving responsibility to protect principle. We also need to recognize, however, that in our lifetimes, where so many transformational events have radically altered our lives and our societies, the collapse of the Soviet Empire, end of the Cold War, cyberspace, and a radically modernized social media market, the Arab Spring, Amazon, and unimagined economic calamities in the much-heralded deregulated marketplace, there also was a transformation during that period of international and national justice for atrocity crimes. What happened? To put it simply, we emerged from the old world into a new world. What was the old world, namely before 1993? Well, in the old world, there were no international criminal courts. That may seem sort of odd to think about today, but frankly, in 1993, we had nothing out there to draw upon. We had the memory of Nuremberg and Tokyo. Those were academically instilled nuggets in 1993, sort of collecting dust. But we hadn't had anything since then in terms of international criminal justice. We also had, in 1993, a basic presumption of leadership impunity. Only a few senior perpetrators had actually been prosecuted in domestic courts between World War II and 1993. The vast majority escaped any legal scrutiny. Pol Pot, Stalin, Idi Amin, Duvalier, Hafez al-Assad, Nicolae Ceausescu, Mengistu of Ethiopia, Sukarno and Suharto of Indonesia, Kim Il-sung, North Korea, Joseph Savimbi, Angola, Robert Mugabe of Zimbabwe. None of them had faced justice. The communist world scorned any true commitment to the rule of law, and the free world exercised it with very great discretion. We also had very poorly understood atrocity crimes. What did we really know about genocide, about crimes against humanity, about war crimes? We had the records of Nuremberg and Tokyo, but very little else. Crimes against humanity remained uncodified and dangerously vague. Genocide was tied to the Holocaust and the Genocide Convention, which had never been enforced. So we did not know how to prosecute these crimes. War crimes were tied to the Geneva Conventions and yet were rarely the object of court-martials, and not since Nuremberg and Tokyo had they been prosecuted internationally. We also had weak national enforcement. Few states had incorporated atrocity crimes into their domestic criminal codes, and that included the United States. And finally, we had no experienced international jurists. There was no body of jurists to draw upon who understood how to integrate international criminal law, international humanitarian law, international human rights law, and the law of war all into one mega criminal trial, competently led by an experienced jurist on the bench. There were no such people in 1993. In fact, I'll just relate to you, as we were building the Yugoslav Tribunal in 1993, Ambassador Albright told me, you know, obviously the United States is going to put forward a nominee for the bench on the Yugoslav Tribunal, and I want, and this these individuals will all be voted on by the Security Council and then the General Assembly. Who would be the American nominee for a judgeship on the Yugoslav Tribunal? Well, she said to me, David, there has never in the entire history of the Permanent Court of International Justice before World War II and the International Court of Justice after World War II, that's the big mega UN court in The Hague that sits in the Peace Palace built by Andrew Carnegie in 1910, there has never been a woman on that bench. It's all been men making law for men. You will break that mold. I want to see a list in front of me of nominees for the American judgeship on the Yugoslav Tribunal, and I want to see a lot of women's names on that list, a lot. So I had my marching orders, and I compiled a list for her of very distinguished women judges in the United States. And one of them was Gabrielle MacDonald, Federal District Court, Houston, Texas, had overseen many criminal trials in federal court. We brought her to Washington for an interview. We were very impressed. But at one point, Judge MacDonald leaned over to me and she said, David, you know, I actually don't know anything about international law. And I said, we know that. I've got some books for you. I got a couple of textbooks on international law. Here, take them. You need to read these. And I've got a text on international criminal law. Take it. Read it, particularly chapters 5, 7, and 8. And she was a quick learner, and she ultimately rose to become the chief judge, the president of the Yugoslav Tribunal in The Hague. But it just goes to show you that in the world of 1993, we were starting from scratch, basically. So what happened from 1993 onwards? Well, the Soviet Empire was gone, as was its anti-legal ideology, and the rule of law had a better fighting chance with new alliances of liberated nations seeking legitimacy through allegiance to international law, although performance has often lagged far behind that even today if one looks at the country of Hungary. But it did mean that on the Security Council, we had a fighting chance to actually bring the permanent members of the Council together on these types of initiatives, such as the international courts. And then over that eight-year period, from 1993 through 2000, five major international criminal courts were negotiated and were essentially created, and that is the Yugoslav Tribunal, the Rwanda Tribunal, the Special Court for Sierra Leone, the Extraordinary Chambers in the Courts of Cambodia, and, of course, the Permanent International Criminal Court. You know, what I did not write about in this book were the tribunals that were never built but really should have been. You have to appreciate how widespread were the atrocities in the 1990s, and I spent an enormous amount of my time in parts of the world where atrocities were raging, and I was futilely trying to build some kind of accountability mechanism to deal with those atrocities. Those sort of failures of building, and I'm describing them in a second, were part of the 60,000 words I had to delete from this book at the editor's instruction. I had submitted a manuscript of 250,000 words, and I got an email back a couple of days later, very polite, from the editor-in-chief at the Princeton University Press, saying, thank you, David. Excellent. We will be looking forward over the next couple of months to your deleting 60,000 words from your manuscript so as to bring it down to a more manageable size of a book. Well, part of that 60,000 is really this story about the failures of tribunal building. Think of the situations, the Democratic Republic of the Congo in the 1990s. More than a million people perished there. Sudan, over a 17-18-year civil war in the 1980s and the 1990s. I actually went into South Sudan. I went into all of these places in rather considerably dangerous circumstances to try to understand these atrocities. Of course, no progress at all in building a tribunal for Sudan. Iraq, under Saddam Hussein in the 1980s and 1990s, a wealth of atrocity crimes to prosecute. And I worked very hard with the Security Council to try to build an international criminal tribunal on Iraq. Ultimately failed, but it was quite a journey to try to address the Iraqi situation in those two decades. Burundi, there was genocide in Burundi in 1993. I write about it a bit in the book. And we actually got a UN commission of experts set up to examine that, conclude that there was genocide, and recommend the creation of an international criminal tribunal, but we could never come to closure on it. So no tribunal for Burundi. And then finally, Chechnya. An enormous wave of atrocity crimes swept over Chechnya in the southern part of Russia in the late 1990s. And you can just imagine what it was like for me to walk around the State Department and talk to the Russia desk about accountability in Chechnya and what about those individuals in Moscow that lead the government and lead the military. It was not a popular proposal. But in this new world, we also had the beginning of the end of a leadership impunity. And many leaders have been indicted and some prosecuted. Slobodan Milosevic, Jan Kambanda of Rwanda, Charles Taylor of Liberia, the top surviving Khmer Rouge leaders, Radovan Karadzic, Ratko Mladic, Muammar Gaddafi was indicted before his death, Omar al-Bashir, of course. Of course, we had this experience in the late 90s of Augusto Pinochet being subjected to a real threat of prosecution by Judge Garzon in Spain. And while Pinochet was flown back to Chile, once he arrived in Chile, the floodgates had been opened, and he was subjected immediately to risk of prosecution back in his own country, and he died before that could be accomplished. But in the new world, we also achieved a much more sophisticated understanding of atrocity crimes. And this is really part of that transformational, you know, two decades that we've just lived through. And for lawyers, of course, this is an enormously important development in international law. We know so much more now about these atrocity crimes. We know rape as genocide. We know what it means to aid and abet genocide. We know about the gravity requirements of these atrocity crimes. How many, you know, what is the magnitude of violence and death and killing that you have to be looking at in order to qualify for international prosecution? We know a lot more about command responsibility and superior responsibility by civilians for these crimes. We know how better to understand specific intent behind genocide, but we also know what inferred intent means now. And we know a lot more about new crimes against humanity, such as forced marriage and forced pregnancy. And we know so much more about the crime against humanity that we call persecution, but which in the popular vein you really know as ethnic cleansing. Before 1993, we had no idea how to prosecute ethnic cleansing. It wasn't even on the map. Now it's all over the map in these courts. And that's just a huge development. And I might also say that the tribunals also adjudicated the crime of torture, whether it be as a war crime or as a crime against humanity, with great depth and sophistication in the late 1990s and early part of this century, to such an extent that one would have hoped that the Justice Department lawyers who wrote the torture memoranda in the Bush administration would have just taken some time to read all of that jurisprudence. It would have been very enlightening about how to understand the crime of torture and thus properly advise the U.S. government on that issue. All right, so it's important that we use and understand atrocity crimes as a preventive tool as well as an accurate description of what the tribunals are prosecuting. By doing so, I just want to point out that very soon you'll learn of a new development in the Obama administration, the creation of the Atrocities Prevention Board, which has been underway for a long time now in terms of development within the government, and it really is intended to try to get ahead of the curve of impending and imminent atrocities to try to organize the U.S. government as quickly, efficiently, and effectively as possible to address atrocities. I had my own experience with this. For the last 2 years of the Clinton administration, I was head of the Atrocities Prevention Interagency Working Group, which was really the predicate to what you're going to hear announced out of the White House very, very soon. And it was an extraordinary experience of trying to get sort of a 5 to 6 month lead time view of the indicators of genocide, the indicators of other atrocity crimes, and to try to shape American policy in anticipation of it and then try to prevent it. And there are so many examples that I could talk about where we either succeeded or we did not succeed in addressing those issues. While that whole concept lay fallow during the Bush administration, the Obama administration has now brought that back in very, very strong form. And it'll be interesting to see now how the Atrocities Prevention Board functions. In the new world, we have much stronger national enforcement of laws of atrocity crimes. As nations join the International Criminal Court, and 120 nations are now state parties to the International Criminal Court, all of America's allies are parties, with the exception of Turkey and Israel. And, of course, the United States is not yet a party. But all of them have joined are looking at their own criminal codes and upgrading them, modernizing them, bringing atrocity crimes into both their criminal codes and their military justice codes so that they're capable themselves of investigating and prosecuting these particular crimes. And if they do so, then they avoid ICC scrutiny. So in sort of an ironic sense, some of our European friends, whether it be Britain, France, Germany, Italy, et cetera, Spain, they actually, in a sense, are almost better positioned to avoid ICC exposure than we are as a non-party to the court. Why? Because they've totally modernized their criminal codes, or at least to a large extent. We have now a much a greater body of experienced jurists, and that has been truly phenomenal. We have judges, prosecutors, defense counsel, court administrators who now know the business of international justice in these tribunals. So we can draw upon a very rich body of individuals for the future. Thousands of law students intern now at these tribunals over the years. So many of mine have. And they come back with that experience, and of course, then they project that into their careers as lawyers, sometimes returning to the tribunals to actually work on those tribunal staffs. Now, what I'd like to do, if I may, is just wrap up this sort of new world view by mentioning that in the book there's a discussion about American exceptionalism, which is such an important feature of the debate in this country about whether or not we should join the International Criminal Court, whether or not we should project ourselves for purposes of international justice. I write about that notion of exceptionalism and whether it, in fact, advances or retards our ability to properly represent U.S. interests overseas. And my conclusion in the book is that the exceptionalism argument is a very debilitating argument for the United States in order to actually advance our interests in international negotiations, particularly for treaty negotiations. It's sort of a naive expression of almost American superiority that, frankly, doesn't sell anymore overseas. It's just not a sellable argument anymore. It doesn't impress them. In fact, it distances, it alienates the very parties you need to strike deals with, that you need to bring them into your persuasive fold on the equities that you want to see represented in the treaty. If you go in there with an exceptionalism argument, you're not going to achieve your objective. And I think that's an extremely important, you know, I'll just tell you one anecdote. While I was negotiating the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court, and I write about this in the book, I used to have so many delegates approach me and say, wait a minute, you just asked us to concede various points in the drafting of the treaty to accommodate American interests in the treaty. We just spent 13 or 14 years of our diplomatic careers revising the Law of the Sea Convention To satisfy your requests, i.e. those lodged by President Reagan in the early 1980s, when the treaty was all done, it had been negotiated bipartisan by Republicans and Democrats for the 1970s. Everyone thought it was on deck, and suddenly President Ronald Reagan came into office and pushed it aside, saying, I don't like it, renegotiate it. Well, countries did that. It took about 13 years to do it. Madeleine Albright actually signed the treaty in 1996 at the United Nations as a revised treaty, having met U.S. interests, which dealt with deep seabed mining mostly. So it was very much a business issue in the treaty. Now, this is a treaty that the Pentagon wants ratified. Everyone, almost everyone, wants this ratified. It's an interesting mystery as to why it cannot get ratified. But in any event, delegates would approach me and say, wait a minute, we just did all this for you, and you're still not ratifying this treaty. It's 1998. What's happening? You want us to concede when we don't even know if we concede these points, you'll be on deck with this treaty with us? Why should we concede anything to you? So it's a very, very important issue in treaty negotiations, and I think it's a very important one. I mean, if we're truly going to try to advance U.S. interests effectively, we have to sort of earn the trust of our foreign friends and allies and others who we negotiate with. Okay, let me tell you very briefly about the book, and then I want to read a couple of passages, if that's okay.
Excellent.
The book has multiple chapters at times about the actual negotiation of the tribunals. You know, what does it take to actually create from whole cloth these international criminal courts? And what is it like to persuade your colleagues in government as well as your foreign colleagues as to how these courts should be administered, what their jurisdiction should be, how they should get their job done overseas. So those chapters are in there. But there are also other chapters. One is about the Rwanda genocide in 1994 and what was happening within the U.S. government during that genocide. And that's a story that's never been told before. So that's in that chapter. Why? Because I was in the policy rooms. I was on the deputies committee. I was immersed in that issue. There's a chapter about Srebrenica, the Srebrenica genocide of 1995 in Bosnia, and what was happening and not happening in Washington during that fateful month of July 1995. So you get an inside perspective of what was going on during the genocide of Srebrenica. There is a chapter entitled Unbearable Timidity, which is about the five-year hunt for Radovan Karadzic and Ratko Mladic in Bosnia from 1996 onwards, and the fact that we failed. We failed to capture them. Radovan Karadzic was not captured until 2008 in Belgrade, and Ratko Mladic was captured north of Belgrade just last year. Both are now standing trial. But they should have been captured on our watch. And I tell you the story of how difficult and frustrating that entire exercise was, particularly for me as the war crimes ambassador. And then finally, there's a chapter on Kosovo and the entire conflict in Kosovo in 1998 and 1999, how the United States mobilized. And for me, it was sort of a very dynamic time because I was actually able, as war crimes ambassador, to project myself with the support of all of my colleagues in the U.S. government, the Pentagon, intelligence community, White House, State Department, Congress, to say, this is a situation of atrocities. Here we are. We're recording it every day. We're telling the story every day. We're trying to keep track of it every day. I was on the border, you know, of Macedonia, Kosovo, interviewing these thousands of refugees coming across the border, having a satellite phone in my hand, calling it back to the State Department as to what exactly were they telling me was happening to them and their loved ones back in Kosovo. So it was a very, very dynamic period with a considerable number of frustrations, but also that important event in May of 1999 when Slobodan Milosevic was actually indicted by the Yugoslav Tribunal right in the middle of the Kosovo conflict. And all of those stories are in this particular chapter. And finally, in the Cambodia chapter, you learn about the hunt for Pol Pot. The sort of untold story now told in this chapter is that the United States pursued the capture of Pol Pot on the ground in Cambodia. We weren't, you know, talking about it publicly at the time, but we were dealing with sort of a chicken and egg problem with the international community. We were trying to build a criminal tribunal on Cambodia, and yet our partners in that community, particularly at the Security Council, were saying, well, you don't have anyone in custody, so why should we take this seriously? After all, this all happened back in the 1970s. What are we talking about here? So we were sort of compelled to try to get custody of Pol Pot and his colleagues in order to make the case for actually building a war crimes tribunal to finally achieve accountability for the deaths of 1.7 million Cambodians in the 1970s. So getting Pol Pot was very important. That doesn't mean we knew where he would be prosecuted. It was a gamble. It was a huge risk. We'd capture him and then try to convince either a national court under universal jurisdiction or the Security Council to build a court to actually get this job done. And we were within hours of actually capturing him when, in fact, his life expired on the border of Thailand and Cambodia. All right. What I'd like to do is read just a couple of passages from the book, if I might. I'm going to skip to Rwanda, if I might, and read you a couple of paragraphs from a chapter entitled, It's Genocide Stupid. The United States failed in 1994 to respond effectively to the genocide that engulfed Rwanda. The reasons did not originate only with the brutal killings of 18 American soldiers on the streets of Mogadishu, Somalia, 6 months earlier. To be sure, that firefight had an enormously negative impact for years thereafter on Washington's attitude about military engagements in Africa or with anything labeled UN, and it shaped the context for failing to intervene to end Rwanda's genocide. But Mogadishu was a distant scream that penetrated the subconscious thinking of policymakers. The real struggle took place over more contemporary issues that required immediate decisions for effective action, but instead triggered a multitude of excuses and devastating delays. For those of us in the policy rooms at the time, the memory of our vacillation over the horror is sickening and will never be extinguished. I owe the victims and their families my soul every day. During the Rwandan genocide, policymakers, including American, European, and UN officials, equivocated and made decisions with tragic consequences. The National Security Council failed to convene the Deputies and Principals Committee soon enough. They could have focused urgent attention on the genocide and sparked bold decision-making and interagency coordination. While the Pentagon tied itself in knots reviewing performance criteria for peacekeeping operations, the State Department remained faithful to a failed peace process that was buried beneath the bodies stacking up throughout the countryside of Rwanda. What happened? The United States responded conventionally to an extraordinarily unconventional crisis and thus lost opportunities to reverse the tide of killings at the very earliest stages. Now, I want to jump very quickly to something regarding the International Criminal Court. This is June 1998. I'm about to get on a plane to fly to Rome for 5 weeks of the end game negotiations to actually negotiate the final treaty on the International Criminal Court. Madeleine Albright and I, she was Secretary of State at the time, we were trying to get a change of my instructions so that we had a more winnable hand in Rome for the United States. And that required some flexibility in terms of what we had been negotiating for years on this court. We had gridlock in the Principals Committee in a May meeting, and so we had to go to the president. I called up the chief of staff, and he said, well, President Clinton is too busy preparing for his China trip in June of 98, wouldn't be able to schedule me in. And I also knew that this was the summer of Monica Lewinsky, so all heck was breaking loose in Washington. But the chief of staff said it would be possible for me to meet with the First Lady, with Hillary Clinton. Now, I had met her before on several occasions because she was a very close colleague and friend of Madeleine Albright's. And, of course, if you work closely with Madeleine, then you might have an intersection with Hillary, and that certainly had happened. So I said, of course, I would meet with her, and she had the president's ear. But on that day in June 1998, Hillary entered the map room of the White House with Milan Verveer, her chief of staff. Eric Schwartz of the National Security Council, Jamie Baker, one of his deputy lawyers, and I took our assigned seats on the couch and assorted chairs. Hillary appeared tired and drawn, as if she had been through some kind of hell and back. I worried what that might mean for the fate of our discussion, but I plunged ahead, explaining precisely what Albright had set forth in the late May teleconference as the shift we needed in the U.S. negotiating position. Baker then weighed in with the Pentagon's view, to hold firm on the longstanding American requirements. Hillary asked how the negotiations had gotten so convoluted with such complexities over jurisdiction. Why not, she asked, just have a global war crimes tribunal modeled on the Yugoslav tribunal, which was created by the Security Council? When this all got started, she thought we would simply reproduce the Yugoslav tribunal on a world stage. I explained why the International Criminal Court would be a treaty-based court independent of the United Nations, and that after years of negotiations, the situation had changed as governments expressed their largely negative views about the Security Council controlling a judicial process. Hillary expressed her amazement that the French did not find the International Criminal Court abhorrent, given that country's involvement in Africa and the exposure of their forces there. I explained that France was one of the most engaged governments in the negotiations and saw this as a means to lead in Europe and in the realm of international justice. I also knew they were likely to sign the Rome Statute, perhaps even at the conclusion of the diplomatic conference. She absorbed without flinching Baker's condescending warning that since the president finally understood the role of the military, if he were to support the Pentagon's position, President Clinton would earn the military's permanent respect and allegiance. And that meant he needed to back the current U.S. insistence on full immunity from prosecution by the court as both a non-party state and as a possible future state party to the court. In rebuttal, I reminded her of the futility of trying to attain full immunity that would extend even to our status as a state party, and that it was undercutting our credibility to achieve major objectives in the treaty. Hillary paused to reflect, thanked us, and told me she sympathized with how difficult my job would be in Rome. I saw that as a signal that she would advise the president to back the Pentagon's futile position, and that is exactly what he did. And Alice, should we now take some questions?
Yes. Thank you very much, Ambassador Scheffer-Litz, author of All the Missing Souls, A Personal History of the War Crimes Tribunals. I am Alice McKeon and shall be moderating today's audience question period. So let's begin. Two members of our audience have asked parallel questions. What will it take to get us, to get the U.S. to join the International Criminal Court, as you had addressed that a little bit?
Well, I have long advocated that we should move towards ratifying the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court. There's a lot of writing in this book about how I struggled after Rome when I had to call for a vote rejecting the statute. And of course, I lost that vote big time. But in the 2 years after Rome, I had to work very, very hard to get the United States back into the game. And by the end of that period, on December 31st, 2000, I had the privilege of signing the treaty at President Clinton's request. And that meant that the United States is a signatory to the treaty. Whether we could become a ratified party is a difficult proposition still because of the makeup of the United States Senate, and also just the fact that this kind of treaty still requires an enormous amount of education within the American populace generally. When we take polls of the American populace, they actually by significant majority agree that we should join the International Criminal Court. But that message does not resonate on Capitol Hill as a majority point of view yet. So there's still a lot of work that has to be done. But let me say this. I've written a lot about what could be the best strategy for joining the International Criminal Court. Some of that writing is in this book. Some of it's in my law review articles. But I think it's extremely important to understand that in some sense, and I don't want to be too dramatic when I say this, but in some sense, the United States is becoming a de facto member of the International Criminal Court. Now, what do I mean by that? What I mean is that, particularly under the Obama administration, but even in the final stages of the Bush administration, the United States has been cultivating and undertaking broad cooperative efforts with the International Criminal Court. Let me give you some examples. We use our power in the Security Council as a permanent member to refer situations to the court. We did so, we actually abstained in 2005, which was sort of the turning point for the Bush administration to get Darfur before the International Criminal Court. Last year, Ambassador Susan Rice took the lead and pushed forward a resolution, a Security Council resolution 1970, which referred Libya to the International Criminal Court. The United States has stood very, very firm now, both under Bush and under Obama, not to allow or not to have the Security Council suspend the indictment against President al-Bashir of Sudan, which has been requested by the African Union. But the United States has led the effort to block that and to not suspend that indictment. He is indicted for genocide. Let's get down to business with Mr. al-Bashir. The United States, just last year in October, we deployed 100 military trainers to Uganda to work very closely with the Ugandan army to capture and bring to justice, namely to send to The Hague for trial, the four indicted fugitives of the Lord's Resistance Army, including Joseph Kony. That's an ICC mandate to try to get them in the courtroom. And the United States is now working very, very closely with Uganda to try to achieve that objective. We also have large delegations now as observer delegations at all meetings of the Assembly of States Parties of the ICC, something that we never did during the Bush administration. So there's just all sorts of stuff going on. That just is part of it, which really demonstrates that although we're not a member state, we can do a lot of things to actually facilitate the work of the International Criminal Court.
Excellent. Thank you. Following on to that, a question: discuss Mugabe. Why was he not indicted?
Robert Mugabe of Zimbabwe. Why was he not indicted? The difficulty there is that Zimbabwe is not a state party to the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court, so it's difficult to have any sort of automatic jurisdiction over Zimbabwe. The only way this could happen would be if the Security Council referred Zimbabwe to the ICC in the same way that it did Darfur and Libya. And that simply has not occurred. Theoretically, it could, but that sort of political momentum and imperative has not gelled with respect to Zimbabwe. But it certainly is not outside of the realm of possibility that something like that could perhaps occur. But it is difficult with Zimbabwe in the absence of a Security Council referral.
Thank you. And follow on to that is, why is it so difficult for the United States Congress to acknowledge the genocide of the Armenian people at the hands of the Turks? I believe you mentioned Turkey as a member.
Turkey is not a member of the International Criminal Court. And this may be one of the reasons why it's not, because it has a historical issue with respect to the Armenians and the what I call, safely, the atrocity crimes against the Ottoman Armenians between 1915 and 1919 or 1920. This whole issue of sort of legislating condemnations of past genocides, particularly those in deep history, or even more relevant, within the last century or so, is a very, very, as all of you know, a very controversial one, to have politicians actually render those judgments. But nonetheless, This has always been a duel between the U.S. Congress and the executive branch, and particularly the State Department. When I was ambassador at large, I dealt with the Armenian issue within the State Department, and I met always resistance, certainly from the Turkish desk and the European desk, et cetera, as to why create a political firestorm with particularly our relationship with Turkey by putting that sort of what was regarded as very provocative language into a legislative instrument. Therefore, you always have, and this is true under Republicans, it was true under President Bush, you always have the executive branch trying to resist the congressional effort to condemn what happened to the Armenians as genocide. And I don't know how that will be resolved, actually, in the future. The one thing I would try to counsel about is, as you know, in Europe, we have this paradoxical situation of Turkey criminalizing any affirmation that there was an Armenian genocide, and other European countries criminalizing the denial of the Armenian genocide. So you have these two competing criminal phenomena in Europe on polar opposites. And even Denk, who was assassinated several years ago in Turkey, someone who had written so much about the Armenian genocide, but also wanted to build bridges with the Turkish government about how to work this issue. I had the privilege of interviewing him a few months before his assassination, and I was just so impressed with his willingness to try to find some common ground with the Turkish government on this issue. He even said that, if necessary, he'll go to Europe. I think he said this. I seem to recall reading that he had said this. If he went to Europe or to the European mainland continent, to a jurisdiction that criminalizes the denial of the Armenian genocide, he would stand up and deny the Armenian genocide just because it's a freedom of speech issue. And, of course, he was a journalist. He wanted to preserve freedom of speech. And so in his view, you don't approach the issue by criminalizing the way in which people express themselves, but certainly the issue of a parliament condemning and reaching the judgment of condemnation is obviously something that we would expect parliaments to take up and consider.
Thank you. And I had another question. How do you see the role of social media in ending impunity? And does the U.S. or UN have an early warning system when a country or failed state should be monitored and perhaps intervene?
There's all sorts of early warning methodologies that are being employed by the United Nations, by non-governmental organizations. I think one of the most exciting fields of that development is the ability to give large numbers of villagers throughout vast outbacks of dangerous country, whether it be in the Congo, in Sudan, or elsewhere, the means to electronically alert the international community as quickly as possible that they're under attack, that their lives are in danger, because and we have that technology, and there's a lot going on right now to try to make that possible. I mean, obviously everyone knows about cell phones and everything, but when you're talking about vast numbers of individuals in high-risk areas, particularly rural areas, you want to make sure that they have the ability to communicate that alert as fast as possible. And those efforts are underway. Those initiatives are underway. It's a very exciting part of social media, is how do you empower people to protect themselves through the use of social media from the commission of atrocity crimes. And that's a very exciting field of work. But as we know, social media has had a tremendous impact on basically pressuring leaders who are engaged in the commission of atrocity crimes, assaults against their own civilian populations, exposing those leaders. And all we have to do is talk about Syria today and the kind of social media video and tweets and other forms of communication out of Syria that give us a much, much more informed picture of what's going on there. Of course, the great challenge is now what do we do about it? And that gets us into another field of discussion, but the social media is definitely there.
And speaking of the Middle East, how is it that so many of the leaders before 1993 ended up in Saudi Arabia?
Well, you know, before 1993, we had no international criminal courts. There was simply no presumption of actually at policy tables sort of presenting the issue of shall we bring this individual to justice or shall we simply try to arrange a sanctuary for this individual, whether it be in Saudi Arabia or elsewhere. I remember early crisis meetings in the State Department during the transition into the Clinton administration, and in the early weeks of February 1993, the issue then was Haiti and the refugee influx from Haiti. It was a huge crisis, you know, for the state of Florida and otherwise, and we had to deal with that as a crisis. And at those policy meetings, no one was sitting around talking about bringing General Cedros to justice. What they were talking about was, you know, can we find a Panamanian villa, you know, to transport General Cedros to and just get him out of there, because he's disrupting an entire society through his tyrannical leadership. That is always an attractive option, you know, to sit at a policy table and say, well, let's just put this person on a plane and get him out of there. What this book tries to describe to you is that, quite frankly, the transformation of the last 20 years has been that you don't easily simply put that option on the table anymore. You can put it on the table, see if you prevail with it. But the other options on the table are definitely going to be ones of achieving accountability. President Assad today in Syria, people aren't just talking about, oh, how could we fly Assad off to some other jurisdiction, have him step down from government, as the General Assembly today voted he should do. There's also the issue of accountability, and his own people are demanding it. Mm-hmm. And the international community cannot just ignore that and say, oh, well, you know, to heck with the wishes of the Syrian people who are subjected daily to massive atrocity crimes. Let's just put him on a plane and get him out of there. That is not a viable sole option anymore. There are other options that are on the policy table, and that's the transformation of trying to bring that kind of impunity to an end. I think it's for the better. I think it's for the better long term for these societies to know that these leaders have actually been brought to justice.
Yes, and one question following on to that is the ICC conviction rate is low, according to this person's perception, and asks what can be done to improve it.
Well, no one has yet been convicted by the International Criminal Court. There are many trials underway. It's very, very important to understand a couple of things about the early years of the International Criminal Court. And this was true for the Yugoslav Tribunal, for the Rwanda Tribunal. There were long delays in getting the system up and running and moving efficiently. And that's just as true for the International Criminal Court. A lot of fundamental stuff has to be litigated in the early trials about the legitimacy of the court, about procedural rules. A lot of terra nova stuff has to be litigated. Why? Because defense counsel demand it. And it's their job. They're defending their client, and they're going to throw everything they can at the judges about the legitimacy of the court, about the fact that these particular procedures have not, we don't have any rules on this, we have to deliberate this, we're going to file, 10 pretrial motions to address this issue. All of that protracts the trials in the early stages of an international criminal tribunal, and that's just the way it is. It's due process at work. So we are awaiting now the first trial judgment on the Lubanga case out of the Democratic Republic of the Congo. And I think at that point we'll finally have our first conviction out of the International Criminal Court. And then others will follow after that. But these kinds of crimes, these mass atrocity crimes, take years to investigate and years to prosecute. And it's very difficult to short-circuit that. Because the big reason is We're protecting the due process rights of the defendant. We're not ramrodding anything through that courtroom. And that's demanded by the international community in setting up these courts. So if you want to do ramrod justice, you don't want to be in this business, because this is a process that takes these crimes require an enormous amount of investigation. If you're moving up the chain of command to a leader, you've got a lot of work ahead of you to get witness testimony, to get documentary evidence, to try to pin it on that top guy who's very smart and is not trying to leave many traces behind regarding his actions, because he's not out there actually shooting the weapons or anything, but he's guiding it up there. How do you convict someone like that? It takes a lot of investigative work and a lot of trial time to do it. But that is the nature of international justice, and I think we just have to simply get used to it.
Thank you. We've reached the point where there is time for one last question, and a person asks you to please describe the difference between the World Court, International Court of Justice, and the International Criminal Court, and America's involvement therein, or lack thereof, in each, and why can't these be one and the same?
Okay. Well, that's a good logical question. The International Court of Justice in The Hague, which we've had since 1945, it's part of the UN Charter. And before that, it was called the Permanent Court of International Justice between World War I and World War II. That is what we call a state responsibility court. The jurisdiction of that court is only state actions against, you know, government actions against governments. It has nothing to do with individual criminal responsibility. It's not a criminal court. And it was never designed to be one. The International Criminal Court is designed to strictly be a court to bring individuals to justice for crimes. So it's a criminal court. It's an international criminal court. So it would be difficult to bring the two courts together because they function so differently, and frankly, the expertise you need to be a judge in either court is a rather different expertise, as well as being, you know, a prosecutor in the International Criminal Court before the International Court of Justice, where you're representing governments. You're not prosecuting. You usually have the legal advisors of the foreign ministries presenting the cases before the International Court of Justice. They're not prosecutors. They're very competent government lawyers is what they are. So it's just a very, very different dynamic. The United States, until the mid-1980s, actually submitted to what we call the compulsory jurisdiction of the International Court of Justice, which meant that we stood prepared to be sued and to sue, you know, before the International Court of Justice as a government. But the Nicaragua v. USA case, which was the Contra situation in Nicaragua in the 1980s, when Nicaragua sued the United States for the actions of the Contras, President Reagan withdrew us from the compulsory jurisdiction of the International Court of Justice. So now we appear before the ICJ, and we have in many cases, but we do so only voluntarily. We are not obligated to do so, but we do so when it's in our interest to do so. And, of course, with the International Criminal Court, we are not yet a state party, and that has consequences with respect to our exposure to that court.
Our thanks to Ambassador David Sheffer, author of All the Missing Souls, A Personal History of the War Crimes Tribunals. We thank our audience here as well as those listening on the radio. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California commemorating its 109th year of enlightened discussion, where you are in the know, is adjourned.